Hello and welcome to the Journal of Democracy podcast. I'm Brent Kalmer, managing editor of the journal. We're joined today by Adrienne Labaugh. She is the author of A New Twilight in Zimbabwe, The Perils of Power Sharing, which appears in the April 2014 issue of the Journal of Democracy. She is assistant professor of government in the School of Public Affairs at American University and the author of From Protest to Parties, Party Building and Democratization in Africa. So welcome, Adrienne.
Thanks for the invitation.
So let's just jump right into it here. You note that Zimbabwe's recent period of political crisis began in 2000 when, quote, a loose coalition of civil society groups and organized labor succeeded in defeating a proposed constitution in a March referendum, unquote. How did this event alter Zimbabwe's political landscape?
Well, that loose coalition, which then turned into the Movement for Democratic Change, which is Zimbabwe's largest opposition party, this was really an exceptional social movement. So across much of Africa, opposition parties have emerged out of defections from the ruling party, out of elite maneuvering. What you get in Zimbabwe instead is the construction in 2000 of, well, starting actually in 99, of a broad-based grassroots societal opposition to the ruling party. And as I detail a little bit in the article, but much more substantially in my book, the trade unions served as the kernel of this movement. And they were very strategic in reaching out to different civil society partners that had access to different popular constituencies, so that by the time the opposition party was officially launched as a party, the civil society coalition had already undertaken this large-scale constitutional reform campaign. It already had this sense of internal solidarity, and it already had a vote base that reached across regions and across ethnic lines. And this kind of large-scale cross-ethnic vote base is really not typical at all on the African continent. And this is why the MDC in 2000 was able to mount such a successful challenge to this very strong, very entrenched ruling party in Zimbabwe.
And let's fast forward now to July, the 2013 elections that occurred in July. And these saw ZANU-PF, which has, of course, been the dominant party since independence, essentially rout the Movement for Democratic Change. And I want to read you a quote from the piece and get your thoughts on it. You say that, quote, the easy explanations for the opposition's stunning electoral reversal, repression and manipulation by ZANU-PF, do not seem sufficient. The MDC had faced consistent repression, violence, and electoral manipulation throughout the 2000s, yet previous elections were highly competitive. Until July 2013, there was cause for optimism about an eventual election-led transition in Zimbabwe. What changed, unquote. So what did in fact change?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's very important to underline that these 2013 elections were the culmination of the power sharing agreement, which had been put in place since 2008. And in the article, I really put a lot of the emphasis on the power sharing agreement for explaining why you get this real landslide in favor of ZANU-PF in the 2013 election. So the agreement created a government of national unity. It obliged that government to put in place reforms that would even the electoral playing field, and it required the drafting and the passage of a new constitution before the next election. So given all of this, we would have expected higher quality, more competitive elections in 2013. What we got instead were nonviolent yet very heavily flawed elections in which the MDC lost, and you know, I want to underline this, lost by a huge margin. And it was a real difference from the other elections since 2000. So in the article, I say that you get this reversal due to two different factors. First, the power-sharing agreement was flawed, and many of its requirements were simply not implemented. The largest obstacles to democratization in Zimbabwe, which are the very weak rule of law and the politicized nature of the state security forces, these were virtually unaddressed during the power-sharing period. Secondly, perhaps much more importantly, the power-sharing agreement brought the MDC into government. And this created real problems for the MDC. It made it hard for them to fight the 2013 election campaign as an outsider or as a pro-democracy force. And this is what had given it so much of its power during the 2000s. And furthermore, during power sharing, the MDC leadership had failed to invest in its party structures. So you see a real erosion of the grassroots reach of the party. And also, the actions of leadership while in government alienated the MDC's civil society allies and also alienated a large number of MDC voters. So what you have with the 2013 elections is not just rigging, although rigging was there, but also the loss of a viable opposition challenger in Zimbabwe. And so you're then left with unchecked ZANU-PF dominance, which is what you had in the 1980s and 1990s.
Do you think that, the MDC's departure from kind of its civil society roots under power sharing was a necessary consequence of the global political agreement? Was it in some way compelled by that? Or could there have been better decision making that would have assuaged some of those problems that eventually emerged?
Yeah. So I mean, I think in terms of whether this was inevitable, I'd say, you know, yes or no. Yes and no. So first of all, power sharing does put real constraints on opposition's ability to serve as a critic. And the opposition loses its ability to run on its most powerful electoral platform, which is, you know, we are a clean broom. We can remove these crooks who have failed to deliver. So when you bring opposition into power sharing agreements, they lose all of those kinds of benefits. The problem with power sharing in Zimbabwe is that they also lost any of the benefits of power sharing. They couldn't really formulate policies. They couldn't really implement. They didn't get room to rebuild party structures because violence continued. So it, you know, power sharing was a real constraint on opposition. But I think that there are mistakes that the MDC made during the power sharing period that they didn't have to make. So first of all, they could have continued to invest in party structures. And simple things like paying for grassroots registration drives, maintaining a leadership presence at the party headquarters, continuing to have internal party primaries for election open offices. All of these things would have maintained the party as it was before it entered the power sharing agreement. I think another thing that it could have done differently is when it ran in the 2013 elections, the party leaders chose to run on a performance platform. They abandoned all of the rhetoric of democratization that had served them well in the 2000s. And I think that alienated a lot of grassroots supporters, and it also alienated a lot of its grassroots activists. Because throughout the power sharing period, grassroots activists for the MDC had continued to face repression and violence from ZANU-PF. So when they went to rallies and when they heard their leaders sort of talk about policy and talk about governance and not talk about the need to kick ZANU-PF out of power or the need to democratize Zimbabwe, I think a lot of those grassroots activists just lost a lot of faith in the party and a lot of their willingness to continue to mobilize for the party at the grassroots level.
And this seems to be a conflict that continues. Now, the MDC, as I understand it, is currently undergoing a bit of a leadership struggle internally. Can you speak a bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's been, since the article was published, it's been a dramatic few months, both for the opposition and also for the ruling party. So in terms of the MDC, in the article, I expressed the hope, and I think this was the hope of many Zimbabweans, that the MDC would see its electoral defeat as a moment where they needed to take stock of the direction of the party and about what they wanted to do in terms of party leadership. Unfortunately, it seems that that is not what is occurring. So the current crisis really started when several members of the MDC, including a few founding members of the MDC, questioned whether Morgan Tsvangirai, the leader of the party since 2000, whether he should continue in his role as party president and continue to contest presidential elections in future. Those members were all then ejected from the party. Then, at the end of April, Tsvangirai expelled Tendai Biti, who had been the party's finance minister during power sharing, and also one of those discussed as a potential Tsvangirai successor. Biti's real mistake, and the reason he was expelled, was he publicly stated, in contrast to the party's orthodoxy, that the 2013 elections were not stolen by ZANU-PF, but had just been lost by the MDC. So after his expulsion, Biti then organized a national council meeting in which he suspended Tsvangirai and the entire rest of the party leadership, Tsvangirai then organizes his own national council meeting. He expels BT. There's now an ongoing witch hunt within the party for local councillors who were tied to BD and all of the rest, and threats of expelling them. So this has sort of been going back and forth. I think the silver lining to all of this is that all of these people are fighting over the MDC itself. They're not going off and forming their own parties. And so I think there is still a possibility for the party to sort out this internal leadership squabble and possibly undertake some internal party reforms and emerge a stronger and more competitive election competitor in the future.
We've spoken about the MDC in that regard, and there is, of course, also intense speculation on the ZANU-PF side about who may be the successor of Robert Mugabe. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So this succession struggle has been going on for well over a decade now, and it's generally been talked about in terms of two different camps. So the first camp surrounds Vice President Joyce Mujuru. Her real advantage in the secession struggle is that she has control of the grassroots party structures inside ZANU-PF. The other major faction is headed by Emmerson Mnangagwa. And Mnangagwa he's much closer to Mugabe. He owes a lot of his political position to his personal relationship with Mugabe and also his personal relationship to military leaders and the military. So Mnangagwa has never had grassroots support, but he remains this very strong figure because of his ties to the military. This decision has to be made at the upcoming party congress in December, and so it's going to be an issue that is going to dominate over these next months, and it should be resolved in December. For a long, long time, the money, for those of us who are betting people, has been on Mujuru. And I think over the past month, what we've seen is a real weakening of Mujuru's position. And there are two reasons for this. One is one of her appeals has been that a woman should succeed in Mugabe, but she's now facing a challenge from ZANU-PF Women's League leader Opa Mushunguri. Mushunguri has been a powerful but fairly unnoticed behind-the-scenes player since the early to mid-2000s, so I think that's a real challenge. And then this week, there have been reports, and these are only rumors, but reports that Defense Forces Commander Constantine Chiwenga has demanded that Mugabe endorse Mnangagwa as his successor. And since 2008, the military has become a much stronger player in Zimbabwean politics. And so I think it's entirely possible that Mnangagwa is going to end up the successor because of its backing from the military.
And is it fair to say that Mnangagwa would represent more continuity with Mugabe than perhaps Mujuru would?
Yeah, I think for those people who are hoping for a more reformist ZANU-PF that would be open to more political reform, more economic liberalization, Mujuru has been the figure more associated with those kinds of views. Mnangagwa, on the other hand, has been heavily implicated in the violence in 2008, but also heavily implicated in the earlier 1980s repression, state repression that occurred in western Zimbabwe that cost several thousand civilian lives. So Mnangagwa is much more a hardliner, and he's also someone who would not push for reform in the military. And if we view the sort of military and the lack of political reform within the state security forces as a real obstacle to democratization, then certainly Mnangagwa succeeding Mugabe would not be a good development.
Okay, Adrian, this is the last question for you. You write that, quote, Zimbabwe's experience suggests a deeper tension in power-sharing agreements. They may be effective in ending immediate crises, but they do not necessarily push countries away from entrenched authoritarianism toward democratization. Could you speak a bit more about that tension?
Sure. I think the tendency in both academia and also in policy circles has been to focus on institutional reform as the pathway to democratization. So the idea here is you put in place good institutions, you get democracy. The experience of late third wave democratizers, including many countries in Africa, suggests that even if you have good quality institutions, if you don't have strong party organizations, you're just not in good shape to get governance, alteration in power, accountability. So I think the question we need to be asking is how to get strong parties and genuinely competitive elections. And improving formal institutions just doesn't get you there. The problem with power sharing and how it's connected to this is that I think it emerges out of a feeling that you get all the elites in the room, they'll do some institutional reform, and they'll get democracy. And I think it also emerges out of a general discomfort with conflict and contestation. Now, for some of us who believe that democratization and party building are both more likely to occur out of confrontation and competition, then power sharing is not the route to that. So power sharing dampens elite competition. It either compromises or weakens competition. It doesn't really have any good boosting effects on grassroots party organization. So there are certainly times when power sharing is useful. If we're talking about ending civil wars, I think it's probably a good pathway. But if we're thinking about long-term democratization and how to build strong party organizations and how to build really competitive elections, then I think power sharing undermines those developments rather than enhancing them. And that's particularly true when it's a product of external pressure, as it was in the Zimbabwean case, and as it was actually in the Kenyan case as well. So I think in the article, I just try to be a little bit skeptical about power sharing, because I do feel that it's become this default external response to political crisis on the African continent.
It's a fascinating insight. And on that note, we will thank you, our guest, Adrienne LaBaugh. She's the author of A New Twilight in Zimbabwe, The Perils of Power Sharing. Thank you so much for being with us, Adrienne.
Thanks for having me.